From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect Weekend. I'm Joy Powers.
And I'm Bonnie North. Coming up on the show today, a look back at our Project Milwaukee series, Segregation Matters. Historian Reggie Jackson examines the roots of segregation in Milwaukee.
The segregation that we have in terms of people of color, Latinos and blacks in particular, that segregation was created by a variety of different institutions and individuals.
Then this week's edition of Radio Chipstone explores the history of black male suffrage in the state of Wisconsin.
It was a contentious idea to even consider black male suffrage in 1846, and this is true throughout the North. Black men, for the most part, are barred from voting.
Plus, we'll bring you the latest episode of our storytelling series, Ex Fabula. Lake Effect Weekend comes your way next. News is first. Good afternoon. This is Lake Effect Weekend on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Joy Powers. Every year at WUWM, we highlight a single issue impacting the Milwaukee area in a series aptly titled Project Milwaukee. We just wrapped up this year's series on police and community relations here in the city, but we thought today we'd take a look back at one of our previous series called Segregation Matters.
In it, we explored how segregation is quantified, what it means for Milwaukeeans living with it, and the true costs for our community. We also looked at the roots of segregation in the region, which happens to be the work of researcher Reggie Jackson.
Jackson is head griot at America's Black Holocaust Museum. He also has produced a series of presentations called The Hidden Impact of Racial Segregation on Milwaukee County. In an interview that first aired last year, Jackson discussed his research with me and the many ways segregation was sanctioned and cultivated in our region.
For the most part, the average person, if you ask the average person about segregated neighborhoods, people will respond that, well, people live where they want to live because they want to live near people who look like them. And so there's this idea that people self-segregate. But the reality is that there's never really been self-segregation in Milwaukee. The segregation that we have in terms of people of color, Latinos and blacks in particular, that segregation was created by a variety of different institutions and individuals to basically maintain certain communities as all-white communities. So it was done with a purpose behind it. And most of that history is stuff that people aren't aware of. They don't know the details of the mechanisms that created it.
What's most important to know about when and why African Americans first settled in the Milwaukee area?
Well, you know, Milwaukeeans, the black community in particular, was here when Milwaukee first started. There was a small black community, and that black community was very active in Milwaukee early on, but they were discriminated against very early on. The first election in Milwaukee in 1835, there was a black person, Joe Oliver, actually voted. He was one of 39 people who voted in the first election in Milwaukee. But shortly thereafter, when Wisconsin became a state, they actually barred blacks from voting in elections. And so that was a challenge to blacks in Milwaukee. And for years after that, the black population grew very, very slowly. You know, in many of the cities in the Midwest, Detroit, Chicago, places of that nature, Cleveland, the black population began to grow pretty steadily after World War I because of the industry for the war machine. And then it grew tremendously in the 1930s, a great migration of blacks out of the South who were moving to the North specifically, not necessarily for the jobs. That was obviously a motivation, but the main motivation was to get away from Jim Crow segregation and violence and lynchings in particular, because there had been just a huge number of lynchings from the 1880s through the 1920s. That was the heyday of lynching. More people were lynched in that period of time than any others. And so the black population in Milwaukee stayed pretty small. In fact, it didn't grow very rapidly until the 1950s, and it exploded in the 1960s, 70s, and 80s. So the black population in Milwaukee, if you look, say, at 1940, there was a small black population, and they were very isolated in terms of the neighborhood that they lived in. It was bordered by 3rd Street to the east, 12th Street to the west, I believe Juneau was the southern boundary, and Clark Street, I believe, was the northern boundary. So they were stuck in that particular part of Milwaukee. That was a part of Milwaukee that used to be initially occupied for years by Germans who immigrated to Milwaukee, and then the Germans moved out of that community. The Jewish population moved into that community, and as the Jewish population moved north and west, blacks kind of followed them into that neighborhood. And they were stuck there. They weren't allowed to move to other places. There were mechanisms in place that kept them in the boundary that they were in. And even those who had the ability to move out elsewhere couldn't. And that ended up being the oldest housing stock in Milwaukee for the most part. So very dilapidated houses. You know, most of the people were renters. And were paying exorbitant amounts of rent. People were staying with multiple families in the same home. So it really wasn't a very pleasant place to be, and it became, you know, considered by the city to be a slum area very early on.
Now, when you're talking about mechanisms, is that really redlining? Is that what we're talking about?
Yeah, redlining was obviously one of them. There were several others, but just to kind of address redlining, redlining came about as a result of actions by the federal government. So they created an organization to basically draw these maps that they call residential security maps. We know them as redlining maps. So the HOLC, the Homeowners Loan Corporation, I believe was the name of it, they created these maps. So they went to 239 cities around the country, and they used information from local people. So they talked to banks and to realtors and people who knew the lay of the land in different cities, and they drew these maps. And there were four different designations in terms of what an area would be called. The top one was areas that were considered to be very desirable and easy to get mortgages in. And then the second tier were some that were, you know, not doing quite as well, but were still pretty desirable. And then there was a third designation, which were areas that were beginning to kind of fall apart for whatever reason. And then the last area, the area that they designated with the color red, were the areas that were considered least desirable. It was very difficult to get mortgages or insurance, practically impossible in many of these areas. And so when you look at the residential security map of Milwaukee for 1938, you find that there were actually 19 areas in the city or in the county that were redlined. And so only three of those 19 were actually redlined because of who lived in those communities. And basically what happens if an area was redlined, you wouldn't be able to get insurance, you wouldn't be able to get a mortgage in those neighborhoods. And so it was very difficult for people to have any level of economic success in those neighborhoods. They would maintain themselves as just renters. They'd never become homeowners. And so that's where a majority of blacks in the city were. Close to 100% of blacks lived in that red line area. And so some of the other things that created, the segregation, some of the other mechanisms that were in place were also related to the federal government as well. The federal government mandated that the Federal Housing Authority create policies to direct realtors and bankers, mortgage lenders, how to deal with people from different groups. And so they basically gave them the tools to utilize racial restrictive covenants. In fact, they recommended the use of racial restrictive covenants. And one of the tools that was used early on to kind of segregate blacks out of white communities was to use different zoning laws. So they created zoning laws that would bar, you know, people. But those became less effective. They were challenged in court. And so they began to use racial restrictive covenants in the 1920s. They became very popular. And these racial restrictive covenants were covenants that were attached to the deed as you purchased a property. So in new communities that were growing in the city of Milwaukee, as the city expanded and got larger, in suburban communities that were created, many of these new communities would have these racial restrictive covenants attached to the deed. And it was enforceable. Basically, what they would say is that a majority of the ones that I've seen, they said that this property could not be occupied by people other than the white race. So they barred people of color. Many of them specifically stated that blacks specifically could not occupy these spaces. And there was a caveat in some of them that said, if that person was a domestic worker who worked for the owner of the property, they could occupy that space. Other than that, they weren't allowed in that space at any time. And so these became the primary tool that people used to keep blacks out of certain neighborhoods. And they were also used against Jewish citizens as well. Eventually, Latino and Asian people were classified as undesirable people in those neighborhoods, and they were restricted. So if you were a person who owned that property, if you purchased that property, you had to abide by the terms of that racial restrictive covenant. And they usually had a date that it started and then a date that that restrictive covenant would end. And in many cases, they would actually have extensions. Say it would last for 10 years, and then after 10 years, would be reassessed, and then the people in the community could vote to extend it further. And many of them, you know, were created in the 1920s, 1930s, 1940s, and they extended into the 2000s. You know, there was one that I saw, I believe was created in 1937, and it was set to expire in 2024. And that was one in South Milwaukee. So if you look at Milwaukee County, of the 18 suburbs of the city of Milwaukee in Milwaukee County, that 16 of those actually used racial restrictive covenants. The only two that didn't, I believe, were River Hills and Oak Creek, but all of the other 16 used them very extensively. You know, another tool that was used was called block busting. And so the way that worked is that when blacks or some other undesirable group began to move into a neighborhood, what they would do is they would begin to scare the people in a neighborhood that, you know, the neighborhood is being infiltrated. You better sell now and get out before, you know, many more of them come. And so people would really get kind of cheated out of selling the home at the price that they should have gotten for it. And what ends up happening is people, you know, when you reach this place that they call a tipping point, typically 15% of the neighborhood becomes black, then whites begin to move out very rapidly. And so there's a quick turnover in the neighborhood, and that was done specifically by realtors and the banks to make sure that if they were beginning to move into the neighborhood, that they would take advantage of that and convince whites to move out as quickly as possible.
And that's a process I think a lot of us call white flight, right?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it was white flight that was not – there's two different types of white flight. That specific white flight was a white flight that was orchestrated specifically by the real estate industry to take advantage of those neighborhoods that were transitioning. They knew which the neighborhoods were because they were the ones that were steering people to particular neighborhoods. And so that type of white flight was really kind of in a more of an unnatural white flight because people were convincing you it's time to get out. The other white flight that took place were simply whites deciding that blacks were getting too close to them. You know, Milwaukee saw a huge, huge drop in its white population beginning in the 1960s. You went from well over 600,000 whites in Milwaukee in the 1960s to, you know, 200 and some thousand 40 years later. So a huge number of whites began leaving the city. There were two primary reasons. Number one, you know, is obviously blacks were moving to the city in very large numbers at that time, and they wanted to get away from them. Another issue was that manufacturing jobs were beginning to go away in Milwaukee at that time. And also, in addition to that, the suburbs were growing. You know, we tend to forget that suburban growth in Milwaukee as well as other cities was something that didn't just occur naturally. It occurred as a result of funding by the federal government. The federal government took monies that were designated in years past to central cities like Milwaukee and Chicago and Detroit and Cleveland, and they began to shift that money into suburban communities. So they began to build an infrastructure for these suburban communities. They built freeway system to get people out to those suburban communities. And so they shifted a huge amount of money from one area to another, and the cities ended up suffering tremendously. And it was an enticement for whites to move out to the suburban areas to get away from the cities. And another, you know, thing that played a huge role in it was the GI Bill after World War II. The GI Bill allowed people to get VA guaranteed mortgages on homes at, you know, very low rate mortgages, terms that weren't available before. And they were primarily used by whites to move out into suburban communities. For the most part, the way the federal government set the program up, they allowed the states to basically control how those terms were set for who could get the mortgages from the VA. And for the most part, blacks were discriminated against. By far, a majority of those loans went to whites. Blacks were not allowed to get them because their neighborhoods were still redlined. And so as a result of the redlining, they couldn't get a mortgage because they couldn't get insurance. And so that created a tremendous level of growth in the suburbs in terms of whites leaving big cities. So you have these new communities. You have new homes. You have people being able to get these mortgages backed by the Veterans Administration. But you had to have jobs that would allow you to be able to afford those. And another part of the GI Bill was allowing people to go to college and to tech school. And so they put that program in the hands of the states as well. So what you find is that a majority of people who were able to take advantage of that GI Bill, the education piece, were whites as well. So they were able to go to technical school or to colleges and universities and get these new jobs and get these middle class economic jobs. And so this now allows you to go into these new communities and buy these brand new homes, which were more expensive than the ones back in the city. So it was all of these different things tied together that made it really a point of, you know, kind of unnatural white flight. People chose to leave, but they chose to leave because now they had places to go. They didn't have to stay in the cities anymore. So, you know, it was implemented in such a way that it created advantages for whites and disadvantages for blacks and Latinos in particular.
I'm speaking with Reggie Jackson right now. He's the head griot at America's Black Holocaust Museum. And we're talking about the history of segregation in Milwaukee. So a lot of these issues came to a head during the fair housing protests in the 60s. A lot of people look at it as a major point in Milwaukee's civil rights history. Can you talk a bit about the marches and what they really ended up meaning for civil rights in Milwaukee?
The effort ended up lasting for 200 days. They had these marches for 200 straight days, and they finally ended 200 days later. The federal government had passed an open housing law, which outlawed many of the things that were in place. It outlawed redlining. It outlawed permanently the racial restrictive covenants. And it basically created a mechanism for people to file complaints for being discriminated against in housing. And so shortly thereafter, the city of Milwaukee passed this open housing ordinance, and which was actually stronger in many ways than a federal law. And so, you know, we look at it and we celebrate it. Obviously, the 50th anniversary of those marches, which lasted from 1967 through 1968, will be celebrated here in Milwaukee. But as I looked at the data, there was a special census done in Milwaukee in 1975. When you look at the black population on the South Side prior to the open housing marches versus the black population 8 years later in 1975, I was really surprised at the lack of impact that it had on the South Side in particular. Now, obviously, blacks were able to move further north and further west into communities, but they really didn't move into the South Side at all for the most part. So when you look at the numbers of blacks in many of the neighborhoods on the South Side, they were still in single digits 8 years after this open housing march and this push to allow blacks to live on the South Side. So blacks still did not move into, you know, communities where white people lived. The communities that they began to move into, they became pretty much all black as whites left those communities. And so even though we celebrate it as this monumental event and that it really changed the city, it really did not change the dynamics of what the neighborhoods looked like. The neighborhoods continued to be segregated. It was just the fact that blacks moved into the communities, whites moved out. So you went from a community that was all white to one that was all black, and you still had segregation. And so, you know, I kind of look at those marches, and obviously they were an important part of Milwaukee's history. But realistically, when you look at the impact that it had in Milwaukee in terms of blacks marching to the South Side in anticipation that they'd be able to move to the South Side, it just didn't happen.
It seems like a lot of the time in these kinds of conversations where we're talking about the history of segregation in Milwaukee, we tend to end in the civil rights era. We end it at, okay, well, now housing is open and everything's great now. What was happening in the 80s, 90s, 2000s to solve the issue of segregation?
Well, not very much. The open housing ordinance in Milwaukee was created, but it was never really enforced. There wasn't a mechanism to enforce it to an extreme level. Obviously, it was a law that was in place. The federal law mandated that discrimination in housing would be illegal. And the Department of Housing and Urban Development during the Nixon administration, when this law came into being in 1968, Mitt Romney's dad was actually in charge of housing and urban development. And he pushed this program he called Open Communities, where he would actually take this new law and he would use it as a hammer to slam any communities, any states that would allow housing discrimination to continue. So basically what he would do is he would deny them federal funds if they allowed housing discrimination to occur on a regular basis. And so this Open Communities program that Mr. Romney started, shortly thereafter, he threatened these different communities around the country. They obviously complained to the Nixon administration, and President Nixon ended the program immediately. And he said there was a secret recording, H.R. Haldeman, I believe he was speaking to about this, and he said that he doesn't believe that forced housing, open housing, is a good thing. And he says, I know as a result of us not implementing this law that it will create communities that will still be all white or all black and will create schools that are primarily black and primarily white. You know, we'll just have to take that, but we're not going to enforce this law. And so that really became kind of the policy of HUD on the federal level. And it really, throughout the 1960s, 1970s, 1980s, 1990s, 2000s, 2010s, it's still never really been enforced for the most part around the country. On a local level, you know, when we look at the mechanism that's in place to prevent housing discrimination, there's just not enough manpower there to really go out and investigate all of these complaints of housing discrimination. And so even though we have this ordinance, it really is, in many respects, kind of useless. You can't have an ordinance that says you can't discriminate and then not have a mechanism to investigate the discrimination and then do something about it. And that's basically what we have here in the city of Milwaukee. We have an open housing ordinance. We have a federal law that bars discrimination in housing, but we don't have the machinery to enforce it. Or the wherewithal for that part, because if this is something that the city really wanted, then there would have been very strict enforcement of it. But that has never really existed in the city of Milwaukee for a variety of different reasons. That, you know, I don't believe that people have had the political will to do it, because if it was important enough, it would have been done.
Well, Reggie, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect and for speaking with me today.
Yeah, it's been an absolute pleasure, Joy. Thank you so much for inviting me.
Reggie Jackson is the head griot of America's Black Holocaust Museum and the producer of a series of presentations called The Hidden Impact of Racial Segregation on Milwaukee County. For a longer version of this interview, which first aired last year, head to WUWM.com.
We'll take a short break now, then return with the latest edition of Radio Chipstone. You're listening to Lake Effect Weekend on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Welcome back to Lake Effect Weekend. I'm Joy Powers.
And I'm Bonnie North. In the early 1840s, Wisconsin had high enough population numbers to become a state. There was a mix of Native peoples, Northeasterners, and those from the Upper South. Many came here because of the lead rush in the 1820s and then decided to stay.
There was also a substantial population of Black people, whose arrival can be traced back to the 1720s. Many came to Wisconsin with French fur traders, others with Southern officers, and some arrived as enslaved people. But despite their long history living in the region, Black men were not allowed to vote when Wisconsin became a state in 1848.
Dr. Christy Clark Pujara is an associate professor of Afro-American Studies at UW-Madison. She believes Wisconsinites need to own this part of our history and understand the steps it took to get where we are today. In this edition of Radio Chipstone, Clark Pujara introduces contributor Jonifer Fields to Ezekiel Gillespie and his fight for Black male suffrage in Wisconsin.
By the time we're getting to 1846, there's virtually no enslaved Black people. But the question is, are they going to be part of the state or apart from the state? Are they going to be voters? Are they going to shape the state's first institutions? Are they going to be recognized as citizens? And that is what really the question is. And one of the reasons that the 1846 Constitution did not pass muster, did not get enough votes, was because it was a contentious idea to even consider Black male suffrage in 1846. And this is true throughout the North. Black men, for the most part, are barred from voting.
So now who is allowed to vote at this time period?
Well, in 1846, it's not a state yet, but the people who are voting on whether or not it's going to be a state are all white men. And then when we get to the 1848 Constitution, the one that passes, that establishes Wisconsin as a state, it is very clear who can vote, who's going to be a part of things. And those are white men, and whiteness even supersedes citizenship. So if you read the actual language from the original 1848 Constitution, it says that foreign-born white men over the age of 21 who declare an intention to become a citizen can also vote, because whiteness and citizenship have been so conflated in America and in the state of Wisconsin at that point that whiteness supersedes citizenship. Now, Native Americans can also vote, but there are some very specific terms under which they can vote. They have to be U.S. citizens. Most of them weren't, right, and are not going to be into the 20th century. And they had to denounce any affiliation with a tribe. So basically, they had to become culturally white in order to vote. So again, whiteness is setting the bar for voting. And because the term white is used, it is barring Black men from voting.
So let's talk about Ezekiel Gillespie.
So Ezekiel Gillespie is living and working in Milwaukee, and he is part of a Black community that is small, but very aware that they have been marginalized. And an example of that would be when the Republican Party made universal male suffrage part of its party platform, African Americans met in Milwaukee, said that they were going to support this with everything they had their proceedings published in the local paper, right? They want people to know that they're aware of what's going on, that they understand that they are marginalized and not treated as full citizens, right? Ezekiel Gillespie also goes to a mass meeting in 1865 about suffrage, and this is drawing Blacks from all over the state in Wisconsin. And so he is one of those people who is involved, politically involved, and pushing back against their political marginalization, which they understand is directly connected to their economic and social marginalization. And this is a community that is marginalized in every way you can imagine. So it's a poor community. They are a severe minority, right? They are, you know, less than a couple percent of the state's population. And so they are vulnerable in all kinds of ways. But they also went out of their way to make their demands on citizenship known. And so he tries to vote, and he tries to vote in more than one election. And in the 1865 election, he tries to vote with the intention of being turned away, because he's going to then work with Sherman Booth to sue that he should have the right to vote as a citizen.
And who is Sherman Booth at this time here? What would lead him to take the case?
Sherman Booth is one of a small group of active white abolitionists in the state of Wisconsin. And I use the term active very intentionally. Many whites in the state of Wisconsin were anti-slavery. There were very few people who were actually abolitionists, meaning those who are actively working to destroy the institution of slavery.
Was one of the excuses or reasons for not allowing Black male suffrage at this time period, was it number? Was it tied to the population is so small? What difference would it make?
No. It's simple racism at this point, meaning that in the 1840s, the United States of America is a country that supports and protects the institution of race-based slavery. And slavery is not a regional institution, it is a national one that is supported North and South, that is invested in by Northerners and Southerners. And so it's not surprising that Northerners contested Black suffrage. Of course they did. Free Black people were an anomaly. When you have a system in which race is used as a justification why an entire group of people is held in perpetual bondage and treated as simple chattel in law, free Black people interrupt that. And so they themselves, by just existing, are an anomaly and are an affront to the justification of race-based slavery in which the U.S. economy is grounded.
Christy, we have Ezekiel going to vote. Walk me through the timeline of what happens after that.
So he's turned away, and he files suit. He files suit at the local level, and he loses, and he knows he's going to lose. It gets to the state Supreme Court, and the state Supreme Court looks at his case, and they don't say that Black men should vote because it's morally right or they're citizens. They say that the State Board of Canvassers wrongly interpreted a referendum on Black male suffrage in 1849. So a year after Wisconsin becomes a state, in 1849, there is a referendum on Black male suffrage. So it's put on the ballot. And so everybody that's voting is a white man above the age of 21 and a few Native Americans who are citizens and have denounced any affiliation with a tribe. And so in that referendum on Black male suffrage, it was approved by a vote of 5,265 to 4,075. However, 31,759 voters did not vote on the referendum at all. They left it blank. The State Board of Canvassers interpreted those absentee ballots as no's and said that there was a bar on Black men voting. What the Supreme Court decides in 1866 is that the Board of Canvassers wrongly interpreted those absentee ballots, and they should have just only considered those who actually voted. And so for 17 years, Black men in Wisconsin are disenfranchised, unable to participate in the creation and the shaping of the state's first institutions on a legal technicality. But what I find particularly interesting is that in two subsequent referendums on Black male suffrage, one in 1855 and one in 1865, nearly all voters vote on the Black male suffrage issue, and they vote no. And that would have been the end of it, save Ezekiel Gillespie's suit.
As this is going on, is there a seat of Black power in Wisconsin? Are we focused in Milwaukee? What happens once he sues and it's overturned?
If there is a seat of Black power, and it's a very small population, it is going to be in Milwaukee. And what happens is Black people vote, right? And they are part of the electorate, but the vote is not the, you know, doors opening to freedom. And a very clear example of that would be over 100 years later, the Black commandos are walking down the street with people like Val Phillips and Father Grappi fighting for open housing. Right? And so the vote does not open up the floodgates of liberty and justice to African Americans. It just gives them an opportunity to participate in the electorate. But again, that's only applying to Black men. Black women are not going to be able to vote until 1920. But the vote is one of the first things. It isn't the last and only thing.
Material culture contributor Jennifer Fields curates the Radio Chipstone series. The project is funded by the Chipstone Foundation, a decorative arts foundation whose mission is preserving and interpreting their collection, as well as stimulating research and education in the decorative arts.
This week, Jennifer spoke with Dr. Christy Clark Pujara of the Afro-American Studies Program at UW-Madison. We'll take one last break and then have the latest episode of Ex Fabula. That's when Lake Effect Weekend returns on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
3, 2, 1.
Welcome to Ex Fabula!
True personal story.
Ex Fabula!
Exfabula is a Milwaukee nonprofit committed to strengthening community bonds through the art of storytelling.
And that means it's time for another edition of Exfabula Radio on Lake Effect Weekend. I'm Rachel Owens, joined again by Exfabula co-founder Leah Delaney.
Hello. Guess what else we're joined by?
What?
Well, this really crummy wintry weather.
It was Easter this week, right?
Yeah. No, I have no idea. I don't know. But I've had it up to here at this point, as as well as all of Milwaukee, at least on social media that I see. I think we've all kind of reached our last straw, as it were, on it, which brings us to our show today. Our final Exfabula Story Slam is this Tuesday, April 10th at the Time Cinema. The theme is Last Straw, and here we are contending with our own. So we're going to hear stories that night about jobs, apartments, relationships, just something that you just can't handle anymore. It's all going to happen on Tuesday, April 10th.
Yes, a theme that I think we can all tap into, especially, as you said, this time of the year.
Yeah, I know. It's like we all kind of get that feeling of that, you know, we're all cabin fevered up at that point, and we're just, everybody's kind of had it. So
you just kind of melt down at the oddest moments, just over a cup of coffee or something like that. It's just, it all comes out.
Definitely, definitely. So on that note, let's roll into our very first story. This one was actually from our very first season. Amy Losi tells her Now or Never story from our February 2010 Story Slam. Let's hear Amy Losi.
I have a picture of me when I was getting married, and I'm walking down the aisle, and I'm crying. And if you guys saw the picture, you would look at it, and you would say, oh, look at her. She's crying. That's beautiful. But when I look at that picture, because I was there, I'm not crying. I'm crying. I am crying like a four-year-old girl cries when she gets out of her mother's car and is being led into the doctor's office because she knows she's going to get a shot. I'm crying, okay? Because I never, ever should have walked down the aisle and married that man. I know, I know. But let me tell you, I don't know very many people here tonight, and I know you guys probably don't know me as well, but I bet I can say that I am probably the only one here who was married to a right-wing Republican evangelical Christian engineer. And I was, for 15 years. And during the course of that marriage, I did a lot of things that were wrong, and he did a lot of things that were wrong as well. And it was interesting because we moved out here. We're from California, and we moved out here to Wisconsin. And around about the time we moved out here to Wisconsin, I remember we were sitting at the auditorium for one of my son's concert or band or something. I don't know what it was. And it was over, and my ex-husband, his name is Vance. Vance looked over at me, and he said, Amy, did you know that you were clapping louder than everybody else in this auditorium? And I was like... I was really excited. It was a great concert. He was kind of like, And I know, like I said, I don't know a lot of you, but I wouldn't consider myself to be a sentimental person, but I am a person who has a lot of feelings. I have huge, immense feelings. I feel things. I remember my sister said to me when she was like, Amy, you feel things really hard. And I do. I do. I have hard feelings, you know, and I'm with this man who's telling me that I'm clapping louder than everybody else in the auditorium, and I think there's something wrong with that, and I don't know what's wrong. I can't figure it out, you know. So time goes by, and we go to this evangelical Christian church, and it has one of those rockin' contemporary worships. I love them. I love it. It's there's drums, there's guitar, there's cool contemporary Christian music, and I'm in church, and I'm doing my thing, and my ex-husband grabs me by my arm, and he says to me, Amy, do you realize that you are the only person who's dancing in this entire church? You're dancing in this entire church. And I'm like, I am? I was? Is there something wrong with that? I guess there is. There must be. I don't know what it is, but there's something wrong. There's something wrong with that. And a little bit later, I'm standing in my laundry room, and I'm crying. And I'm really crying. And my ex-husband walks in, and he says to me, why are you crying? And I said, I'm really unhappy. I'm miserable. And he looked at me, and he said, Amy, you better get happy, because you have a lot of things to be happy about. And I thought, really? Do I? Well, okay, I must. And I don't know what they are, but they're there, something, right? And I've got this Gap card, and it's sitting on my desk. I had a little desk in my kitchen. And he said, I want you to go use that Gap card. You know, this is like in May. I got it at Christmas. He's like, my mother gave it to you. She meant for you to use it. Go use it. Oh, I don't want to. I don't want to. I don't want to. And he's like, let's just go. Let's go. So we go to the Southridge Mall Gap. And I love the Gap. I'm like, I drop like $500-$600 at the Gap. I love the pocket T-shirt. I love it all. The chinos, everything. I've got the boyfriend chinos. Remember those? I've got them. I love it. So I walk into the Gap, and I've got my $50 Gap card. And he goes, choose something. Buy something. You know, what do you want? And I'm standing in the Gap, and I started to look around, and I realized there wasn't one thing in that Gap that I wanted, because I didn't have any idea of what I wanted. I didn't know. I didn't have any feelings left at all. And I started to cry. And I stood in the Gap at the Southridge Mall crying, holding that Gap card, and I realized that was my now moment, and I got the hell out of that marriage.
And that was Amy Losey telling us her last straw story.
I can relate to crying in a Gap store, but for different reasons.
Oh, would you care to tell that story right now?
No, not exactly. But yeah, similar theme, the last straw, the just, you know, that's when it happened to pop up. So yeah.
Yeah. You can't control those last straws. Sometimes they just happen at the most inopportune times. So we are talking about Last Straw because that is the theme of our final X-Fabulous Story Slam of Season 9, which is going to take us into our All-Stars event coming up in May, which we're really excited about. So this is everyone's last chance to potentially win the audience favorite for that night to get entered into the All-Stars. But along with that, you know, we're not slowing down, Rachel. We have so many events. We're jam-packed, especially in April. We have a lot of fellowship events that are coming up. And on Thursday, April 12th, Housing as a Public Health Issue is going to happen as our next event. And this is a really great safe space for people to, you know, have conversations about their experiences with housing as a public health issue, as well as hear a couple of our Ex-Fabula fellows tell stories about their personal situations with that as well. With that being said, we are going to move into our second and final story of the day from one of our actual Ex-Fabula fellows. Here's Jacqueline Hassley talking to us about her experience with Race in Place back in January 2018.
Housing hopes dashed by U.S. Supreme Court decision. That could have been a headline in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel in 1975. It wasn't, but it could have been. The story begins 5 years earlier when I received a phone call from my friend Julie. Let me tell you about Julie. Julie and I met in September of 1967. We served together on committees at our parish, St. Elizabeth Catholic Church. We marched together for open housing with Val Phillips and Father James Grappi. We wept together at the death of Dr. Martin Luther King, and we celebrated a short time later when the Fair Housing Ordinance finally passed in the city of Milwaukee after years of effort by Alderperson Val Phillips. We not only worked and served together, we also became good friends during that time. We played together. We enjoyed parties and dances and movies and concerts. Julie attended the wedding, my husband and myself, and later the birth and baptism of our son. We enjoyed each other's families and spent time with each other's families. That phone call that came 2 years later in 1969 was Julie telling me that she was in the hospital. My friend, what was she doing in the hospital? And she told me. She had contracted an illness caused by living in a rat and roach-infested home. Her doctor would not release her until she could find a safe and clean place to live. Would I help? She asked. Of course I would help. She was my friend. Of course. I spent the next few days looking at papers and looking at houses that met Julie's criteria. I found what I thought was the perfect house, a duplex near St. Elizabeth, near a good public school, 3 large bedrooms for herself and her 4 children, a bright, sunny kitchen, a clean basement, and as a bonus, a fenced-in yard. I had told the landlord Julie's situation. He accepted my deposit, a $50 check, And then I called Julie from that duplex. She was still in the hospital. I spoke to her. I thought she was as excited as I was. And then she asked the question. "Jackie," she said, "did you tell him that I was black?" I hadn't. Julie was my friend. I hadn't even thought about it. Moreover, we had marched together for open housing. We had celebrated the passage of fair housing in Milwaukee and later the federal fair housing ordinance. Why would I ask if it was that she was black? She wanted to talk to the landlord, and she did. And I listened in astonishment as the landlord said, "I don't rent to black people." And then I watched, stunned, as he tore up the check and handed the pieces back to me. I was a student at the time at UWM, and I had a work-study job working for WCLU, which is the Wisconsin branch of American Civil Liberties Union. And I went to the director, Ed McManus, and I said, "Ed, this just happened to my friend. Is there something ACLU can do? This doesn't sound right. It feels like it's illegal." He agreed to talk to the attorneys, and he got back to me and he said, "Yes, we can take the case." I asked Julie, and she said, "Yes." And then we spent much of the next year in lawyers' offices, ours and theirs, the defendants. We spent time in depositions, some harsher than others. And then we went to federal court, and we won in John Reynolds Federal Court here in Milwaukee. We celebrated, but not for long, because the court defendant then asked to go to the circuit court in Chicago. And it did, and we won that. And then it went to the U.S. Supreme Court. And those 9 judges ruled against my friend Julie, dashing her hopes and ours for fair housing in Milwaukee and the country.
And that was Jacqueline Hasley's story regarding race and place.
Wow, speaking of health and public housing as an issue, it's striking that in this day and age someone can fall into that situation, contract a disease from where they live.
Yes, it's so true. And if you want to hear more stories from people's situations from housing as a public health issue, please come to our next Exfabula Fellowship event, which is going to be on Thursday, April 12th. Also, again, the theme, Last Draw, Tuesday, April 10th. Come on, Milwaukee, Time Cinema. Definitely pre-register. We actually sold out our last 2 season slams. So we need to get people to go on to exfabula.org, get their tickets in advance, and then show up, maybe tell a story, maybe not, do some active listening, whatever you feel. But we'll be happy to see everyone's face in the place for sure.
Awesome. Well, until the winter weather goes away, it's nice to know we have Exfabula. Well, Exfabula and the Brewers. That's pretty much all we got right now.
That's right.
All right. Well, we really appreciate the stories again and look forward to seeing you again next week. Thanks, Leah.
Thank you so much.
Exfabula is a regular feature on Lake Effect Weekend. Before we go, we thought we'd listen back to one of our performers who appeared on the show earlier this week. Callum Graham is a fingerstyle guitarist who was in Milwaukee to perform at UWM's Zelazo Center, and he joined us in studio to preview the concert. This is his song, Farewell. Farewell from guitarist Callum Graham. And that wraps up today's edition of the show. I'm Joy Powers.
And I'm Bonnie North. Thanks so much for making us a part of your afternoon. Lake Effect Weekend airs every Saturday and Sunday from 3 to 4. And be sure to tune into the weekday version of our show at 10 in the morning.
It's all on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Stay tuned now for All Things Considered. Coming up next, it's 4 o'clock.